Well, Luke chapter 8 this morning, verse 22. One day he got into a boat with his disciples and he said to them, "Let us go across to the other side of the lake." So they set out. And as they sailed, he fell asleep. Windstorm came up on the lake and they were filling with water and were in danger. And they went and woke him saying, "Master, Master, we're perishing." He awoke, rebuked the wind, the raging waves, and they ceased. There was calm. He said to them, "Where's your faith?" And they were afraid. And they marveled, saying to one another, "Who then is this? He commands even the waves and the winds, and they obey him." What a wonderful question. Father, help us to know who you are. Reveal yourself to us. Show your might. Show your strength. Father, sometimes we look at the circumstances of the world and we just, in our hearts, we cry out to you and say, "God, do something just so that people will know you're God and you're in control." And then we fail to look at our own small little circumstances and pray the same thing. Lord, help us to trust you. Help us to believe you are who you say you are, that you can do what you say you can do, that we might commit ourselves to you. Faith believing, hands off, trusting you. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, through the rest of chapter 8, chapter 9, here in Luke's gospel account, you'll find several examples or several illustrations proving Christ's authority over all things, all people, all beings, natural, supernatural. Having established the principle that the followers of Christ are people who hear and do, Luke now gives us a good example and demonstrates to us why we ought to hear and listen and then obey our Lord. It's because God, the Son, is all-powerful. He's absolute. He has absolute authority. He has, because he is God, omnipotence. Meaning he has the ability to do whatever he chooses to do whenever he chooses to do it. Because he's not only the creator of all things, he is the sustainer of all things. Therefore, he has to be the authority over all things. We were reminded this morning in our scripture reading out of Paul's letter to the Colossian Christians that Jesus Christ is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. For by him all things were created in heaven and on earth, visible, invisible, whether thrones or dominions, rulers, authorities, all things were created through him, for him. He's before all things, and in him all things hold together. Now, before us in our text here today is the first of nine different illustrations that we're going to find in the rest of chapter 8 and chapter 9 demonstrating Christ's authority. Luke presents in these various illustrations Christ as a supreme authority over nature, over demons, sickness, death, earthly rulers, even authority over his own coming death, over the disciples, over all powers. And it's highly likely that somewhere in that list, I'm going to find our circumstances, right? Jesus is our authority. Okay, most Christians get that. But that also means that Jesus is the supreme authority over our individual circumstances. And probably most Christians would agree with that proposal. But the question is, Do we live like Christ really is the authority over the circumstances of my life? If Jesus maintains complete authority over all our circumstances, why do our circumstances control us? If Jesus is really in charge of my circumstances, why do my circumstances determine whether I'm going to have a good day or a bad day? It seems like if we really, really believe that Jesus is the supreme authority, instead of our thoughts being consumed by our everyday circumstances, our thoughts really ought to be fixed on Him, focused on Him. But instead, I think most of the time, Christ's followers are actually identified by our circumstances, whether they're good or whether they're bad. For example, we really do know or recognize Christians by maybe their achievements or their failures or their happy temperament or their sad countenance or their success or their loss or their trials or all that other stuff that makes up life, and that's how we know each other. That's how we're identified. Now think about Job. And when I mention the name Job, I'm sure that almost everybody here immediately pictures this poor Middle Eastern ancient guy, terribly in pain, sitting in an ash heap, surrounded by four miserable friends who not only don't they encourage him, but they criticize him, only giving bad advice. Is that your view of Job? Is that how he's identified to you? When I think of Job, my mind pictures the story, the rest of the story, that's given in chapters 38 through 42. Because we learn there that Job enjoyed this unique experience of knowing God intimately on a level that most of us can only imagine. Job should be identified with his incredible knowledge of God, his incredible relationship with God and fellowship with God. And when you mention the name Job to me, that's what I think of. I say there was a man blessed to really know God. Not, oh man, poor old Job. So, here's the question. What identifies you? Do people know you because of your incredible relationship with your Lord that is revealed by your faith? Do you really trust Him with your circumstances? Well, here are these poor disciples in a perilous situation. I think it's very important, but an easily missed lesson here right at the very beginning that illustrates for us the disciples were in the situation they were in because they obeyed Jesus. The Master had given them very clear, very simple instruction. Verse 22, one day He got into the boat with His disciples and He said to them, "Let us go across the other side of the lake." That's easy enough to understand. Probably got in a boat that was maybe owned by Peter, James, John, Andrew, I don't know. Maybe all four of them. I think it was probably a comparatively small boat that probably looked a lot like this. This picture is based on relics that they have found at the bottom of the Sea of Galilee. So probably very similar to this boat. Why are they going to cross the sea? Well, it's obvious that Jesus needed rest, needed to get away from the crowds for a little while. Mark indicates in his account, Mark chapter 5, verse 1, they were crossing the lake to the other side, to the area of the Gerasenes. Matthew tells us, or Mark tells us, that it was right after Jesus gave the kingdom parables. which would have made it evening. I think it's good for us to be familiar with the topographical area which you find the Sea of Galilee, such a centerpiece of the Holy Lands. If you ever go there, you will be on the Sea of Galilee. You won't walk across it, but you'll see it. 13 miles long, technically 13 miles wide. It's wider than it is long. I'm saying long is up and down. Okay, east to west, 13 miles. North to south is 7 miles. This sea, this body of water, is really a lake. Sits at 680 feet below sea level. And it happens to be surrounded by all these hills. It's like a bowl that sits down in the midst of all those hills, which are really connected to higher mountains. And because of that topography, just some serious storms can arise. Because what happens is up in the hills, in fact, you think about it, you look around at certain times of the year around Galilee, look up in the north, and there's Mount Hermon with snow. And it's much colder up at those higher elevations. And sometimes that wind would sweep down those hills right into this cauldron where this lake was, and it would hit the warm air of that lake, and this incredible storm would be stirred up. And that was very common. In fact, back in 1992, one of these storms came whipping down off of those mountains, hit the Sea of Galilee, stirred up waves 10 feet tall, which smashed into the significant city of Tiberias and did some real damage to the city. That's kind of what you could expect at times on the Sea of Galilee. Our text reveals that Jesus told his disciples, get in the boat, let's go to the other side. The disciples accompanied him. And you're probably thinking about 12 apostles in that little boat, just like the ancient painter Rembrandt did. Y'all familiar with that? But this word disciples includes more than the apostles. I think we've pointed that out before. The word disciples very often in the gospel accounts is used to describe all of these people who were following Jesus on some level. And sometimes the word apostle is used to designate the specific 12 who were closest to Jesus. Well, all of those people, however many there might have been dozens or hundreds, they didn't all get together on one nice cruise ship for a nice evening sail across the lake. In fact, Mark says, chapter 4, verse 36, when he gave this account, he said, and other boats were with them. So that's how all the disciples went across the lake. These people who were followers of Jesus, who had given up things to follow him, and sometimes they'd make great sacrifices in order to follow their teacher so that they would be able to learn from him with the idea that they were going to become like him. That was a very common scenario of the peripatetic teachers who traveled across the land in that day teaching. Sometimes great sacrifice was made. In fact, if you were going to be a serious follower of Jesus, you had to make an incredible sacrifice. He put it like this. If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross daily, and follow me. Jesus said that's what a disciple looks like. Well, to some greater or lesser extent, there was a bunch of these, and they got in boats. They followed Jesus. No doubt some of those people were the kind who Jesus said, well, you're really not qualified to be a disciple because you want to go home and spend time with the family. Yeah, I understand that, but if you do that, you can't be a disciple of mine. Or, you know, you put your hand to the plow and then one day you decide you don't like farming and Jesus says, that kind of person, you can't be my disciple. You have to take up your cross and follow me. Those other ones were just followers who, when faced with the demands of being fully committed to Jesus Christ, John chapter 6, you remember we looked at that a few weeks ago. They said, now we can't do that. And your text says they turned around and followed Jesus no longer. They were, based on what we studied recently, they were the stony ground kind of Christians. They were the thorny ground kind of Christians. They were followers of Jesus who heard the good news and they accepted the good news, but the good news never found root with them, and so they never produced spiritual fruit, and they turned around and walked away. But not these people. And other boats followed them, and they went across the sea, or started across the sea. Because like good disciples do, the disciples heard Jesus and they obeyed. Jesus said, let us go across the sea. Last part of verse 22, so they set out. That is a great description of a disciple. In fact, the old preachers of years past would latch onto a phrase like, so they set out, and preach a whole sermon on that, or a series of sermons. And you would take a lifetime to get through Luke at that rate. But what a statement. Jesus said, let's go. And they did. Now, again, a reminder that it's not likely that Luke is listing all of these events chronologically. However, at some point in Jesus' ministry, he gave these various examples and lessons about how the true followers are characterized by people who hear him, and they listen well, and they know what he's saying, they understand what he says, and then they prove that they understand because they do what Jesus told them to do, and they're obedient. And in this case, the command was real simple, real plain, let's go across the lake. Most of his commands are still that way. In fact, sometimes I wonder if we were so busy about trying to put into practice the clear commands of God that we know, we probably wouldn't be so consumed with all the stuff we don't quite understand. And yet it's quite the opposite for us, isn't it? It's more intriguing to delve into the stuff that seems to have no answer. Well, the disciples obey Jesus. And it's not very long before they're in great trouble because they obeyed Jesus. Was the problem that the master fell asleep, verse 23? As they sailed, he fell asleep. Picture this very pleasant evening. Light wind filling the sails of that little boat. It's floating across the sea silently. All the other little boats. If you like water like I like water, that is a very tranquil picture. You think, yeah, I'd like that. That seems like something that would be very pleasing. I mean, here they are sailing along, and the only means of motivation is a force of nature. It is their way of getting from point A to point B. And that force of nature is so pleasant. So helpful. The whole picture just speaks of just this quiet, peaceful little trip across this little lake. And I mean, not even the clanging of oars or anything like that. And I'd like to think maybe even the disciples are even quiet. Maybe even Peter isn't saying anything. You know, it's just quiet. Peaceful. Tranquil. Exactly the way some of us like life. And this is the only place in Scripture that you ever read that Jesus slept. It's a great reminder that He's God the Son, but He's also Son of Man. And He's very human. And He's exhausted. And so we see Him in the back of this boat, lying on a cushion, fast asleep. I think He's comfortable. Mark chapter 8, verse 38 gives us those details. Exhausted, sheer exhaustion from all the work. Sometimes they didn't even have time to eat because the people were coming and going. And as the Son of God, He lies down on this cushion in the back of this little boat and goes fast asleep because He is God the Son, and He trusts His Father implicitly to take care of Him. No sleep aids. Trust the Father. You know what else? As Son of Man, He implicitly trusts these experienced fishermen to get Him across the sea without problems. Isn't that a great picture? No need for Him to stay awake. You know, He doesn't need to stay awake and watch where they're going and give them advice and pester them with this detail, that detail. They're fishermen. They've spent their life on the sea. And about the time this little band of followers of Jesus make good headway across the sea, those same forces of nature turned against the disciples. Last part of verse 23, a windstorm came down on the lake. They, that's the boats, were filling with water. They, the disciples, were in danger. Here's one of those unexpected windstorms that I told you about. Come sweeping down upon this lake. What are you thinking, 21st century Christian? You're thinking, why didn't they check the weather before they left? You know, we honestly live in an age where we take the predictions of weather so for granted. I mean, honestly, folks, how many times a day do you look at your phone and hit the weather app? I do not start a day without doing that. There's three things I do four. I eat breakfast, check the weather, read my Bible, and pray. One is spiritual, the other is common sense. They didn't do that. You know, we might want to chide the disciples, say, why were you being careless? I mean, here you are starting on a trip across the lake that you know can get really riled up with the most precious cargo imaginable in your boat. And you didn't even check the weather. If they would have, they might have known that there was a storm brewing to the north or storm brewing to the west. And therefore, it would have been dangerous for them to get out on that lake that night, but they didn't listen to John Cesarek, so. Hey, do you know the only way these people predicted the weather in those days? Jesus pointed it out one time in an illustration. Red sky at night, sailors delight. Red sky in the morning, sailors take warning. You know, same thing your grandmother taught you before cell phones. That's about the only way they had to predict, and they didn't know. Well, we might say they were just kind of ignorant about what life was going to throw them. You ever feel that way? I mean, here are the sailors starting to cross the lake with precious cargo and they don't even know the circumstances of life. And suddenly they are in danger and it is out of their control, and these are seasoned fishermen who probably have spent almost every night of their life out on this same sea. And they said, we're in big trouble. We are perishing. Now when a fisherman who's that seasoned says, I'm perishing, I'm going to pay attention. They knew what perishing looked like on that sea. You know, it's entirely possible that it was one of those storms like 1992 and they're fighting with 10-foot waves in a 15-foot boat. Literally, the boat was being baptized. Now, that's not a word that's used in your text, but it's illustrated in your text. The waves were sweeping over them, and there's one place in the classical Greek language where the word baptizo is used to describe the waves sweeping over a boat and covering it. Well, these guys were in that kind of a sitting. What a picture of your life and my life. We're cruising on through life. Really trying to, with a clear conscience, just enjoy the blessings that God has poured out on us. In fact, we might even be living in really close fellowship with the Lord. Just enjoying an intimate relationship with Him and His presence. And we try to look at the indications of the future. We try to see things that might be a problem. We try to circumvent those things. It's like we have modern radar and we know where the storm is and we're going to go another direction. We're just trying to use the wisdom that God gives us, and we're just trying to plan well. And we're trying to figure out the future, and we enjoy our fellowship with God and we want it to stay that way. So we just steer our little boat as wisely as we can through life's sea. We eat well. And we exercise regularly. We drive safely, somewhat. Contribute to our savings account. Contribute to our retirement account. Try to make good decisions. Informed decisions. And one day, circumstances of life just sweep down on us unexpectedly, and we never saw it coming. And it's out of control. There's nothing we can do about it. It just overtakes us. And suddenly we're overwhelmed. Having gone to the doctor for our regular checkup, and we get this report that all is not well. We lose our job with no warning. Or there's massive financial downturn. None of that's supposed to happen, not to God's people. He loves us. We're supposed to float across the sea in very pleasant circumstances. And suddenly that relationship on which you depended just suddenly disappears for no reason. Or worse, it's shattered. You can't even figure out what happened. So what do you do? Who do you blame? How do we respond? How do we regain control of the ship of life and safely pilot it to the destination that we planned all along? How do we do that? Well, we cry out to the Master for help, just like those disciples did. Why? Well, because He's powerful. He has more authority than Mother Nature. How do you know? Well, look, He rebuked Mother Nature. Waves are sweeping over the little boat. Christ's followers are absolutely convinced it's a lost cause. We're out of control. We're perishing. Verse 24, they went and woke Him. Say, Master, Master, we're perishing. And the reason I use these words that you see is because many, many people, including Christians, would use this exact phrase to describe what happened. They would say that Mother Nature had just turned against those disciples. That's a favorite statement by commentators on the Weather Channel. They talk about Mother Nature all the time. Who is she? You know where she came from? Well, actually, that concept of Mother Nature precedes even Greco-Roman mythology. It goes all the way back to Babylonian legends. And for almost all generations, throughout almost all the history of man, there's been this concept of the earth being productive, reproductive, that therefore, because it's fertile, you would use a mother figure in order to describe it. And very often throughout the history of pagan mankind, as they deny God the Creator, they attribute all that we see and all this productivity and all this growth to a goddess. Mother Nature. We seldom stop to consider that the phrase itself makes reference to a goddess who created the world and sustains the world and hopefully is happy enough to give us a nice day. And we don't even stop to think about that. And I think the irony of all this is expressed pretty well when where we are, being a buckle of the Bible Belt, Here's a local weather reporter who really does have a claim that he's a Christian. Pick out the one you want. It doesn't matter. And about this time of year, he'll say something like, well, you should be able to get out and have a good day to worship the Lord on Sunday if Mother Nature cooperates with us. That is a horrible mixed metaphor. talking about a false god as we worship the true God. The disciples in Jesus' boat, they knew they were in trouble. I mean, these are experienced seafarers. I don't doubt that they probably had some nights on that sea that were really, really scary, and when there were waves and wind and rain, whatever, but this one's beyond their ability. This time they, the fishermen, are quite sure that they're going to perish. How do they respond? The same way that we should respond when the circumstances of life come sweeping down on us unexpectedly. They cried out to the Master. Master, Master, we're perishing. Really? Do you read this story and wonder, were they really in danger of perishing, or, you know, was that kind of something at the moment? And why did God in heaven, the sovereign God who controls all things for His glory, why did He allow this to happen? And why does the same Master of the universe allow the waves of life's sea to come sweeping in upon you and knock all the stilts out from under your little cabana? And you fall down into the surf. Well, there's two reasons, at least two reasons. I'm going to give you two reasons why God permitted the storm. Number one, God permitted this storm in order to show the disciples their limits, which would allow them to exercise their faith. Okay, that's why God allowed this. Help the disciples to see, you can't control this. This is beyond you. Now, exercise your faith. Second, God allowed this storm in order to allow Jesus to demonstrate why they ought to have faith in Him. It's the lesson He wanted them to learn. And maybe those are the same reasons why the Master of all your circumstances allows the difficult circumstances, to show you where your limitations are, so that you will cry out in faith to the One who deserves your trust. Well, in reaction to the disciples' cry for help, notice what the Master did. He demonstrated His authority. Verse 24, He awoke, rebuked the wind, the raging waves. They ceased. There was calm. Does this strike you, not funny, odd? They go back to the Master. I mean, He's right there at the back of the boat, probably from here to the end of that section right there, just a little ways away. They crowd around Him. Master, Master, we're perishing. Get up. And He awoke, which implies He was sound asleep. And the wind's howling, and the waves are sweeping over the boat, and the disciples are screaming bloody murder, and He's sleeping. How do you do that? Some people do that, you know. When I was a kid, I guess it was a tornado swept by our house. I remember hearing the story. Well, I saw the evidence. There was this huge maple tree out in front of our house. And we were kids. We're upstairs sleeping in upstairs bedrooms. And whatever this was knocked down one of the... I mean, this maple tree is like this big. And it knocked this thing down. And it came over against the house, and when it did, it hit the power lines, which ripped them off the house with sparks and explosion and fire and everything, and I slept through it. It was right outside my window. I wish I could sleep like that still, you know. I'm trying to figure out what it was in that day, but Jesus didn't matter. You know, it looked like the world was falling apart to the disciples, and He's asleep. He's pretty confident. Maybe he was just really, really tired. Or maybe he just demonstrated incredible care, incredible faith in the care of his Father. That Jesus was sound asleep in the midst of this terror and this storm was a really, really good illustration for the disciples. This is how you ought to trust my Father. It's a great illustration for us. Instead of being all upset about the circumstances and beside yourself because you can't control what's going on, why don't you just rest in the Father like the Son does? Well, Jesus rebuked the rogue powers of nature. I like that word, rebuke. It means to speak very seriously, to reprove, to warn or reprimand. You know, it's the kind of thing a parent does to a child who's getting out of bounds, you know, and rebellious maybe, stubborn, not listening. And what does a parent do? The parent does this, brings that child back in order very quickly. You know, it's the same kind of thing teachers do. Same kind of thing teachers used to be allowed to do when they were in the classroom in order to maintain order. So that they can teach the important lessons. I mean, this is the kind of thing you even see in employer-employee relationships. And somebody gets out of line and they're causing trouble in the company. The great employer goes along and brings them back into line. We need calm. We need tranquility. We need peace. Jesus being the creator, the sustainer of all nature, all of it, soundly rebukes this power, wind, waves, I'm supposing probably rain. And he demonstrated, I have every right to do this because I am these elements' creator. I am their sustainer. I control them. And we go back and read the story of Job. And the description that God gives of how he just controls everything. And we say, no. Modern science tells us how it works. Folks, I'm telling you, God controls it. Because he makes all the rules for modern science. So why wouldn't he? Then I wonder, what part of your life doesn't he control? Really sit down and just think about this. What part of your life is outside this circle we draw here? Is God really unaware of your health? I mean, do you have some kind of physical rebellion going on in your body, and God didn't create your body, and so he can't control it and he can't rebuke it and he can't bring about his will for his glory? Are you being persecuted by somebody and he doesn't know it? You mean to tell me he's not more authoritative than your persecutor? Now, what problem can God's child face about which God is just not aware or just unable to do anything in response according to his will? And I know you're some of you are just bound to be sitting there saying, yeah, but if that's true, why doesn't God do something about my storm? Well, have you cried out to him? I mean, have you gotten to the point yet that you really do feel like you're perishing? Maybe the problem is that you're not even in the boat. You're outside the boat trying to swim against the storm with your own strength. I can do this. I can handle this. I've got this, God. I'll let you know if I start to drown. Maybe that's why your storm doesn't change. Maybe you're just kind of barely hanging on to your boat's tiller. Just trying to make sure. I'm just going to make sure this storm is bigger than me. I can't control it before I wake Jesus. You know, I don't want to bother Jesus if I can handle this. Maybe you trust your own ability to handle life's problems more than you trust Jesus with the storm. Because maybe you're afraid that if you wake up Jesus, and you say, I need your help, that he's going to direct your boat somewhere you weren't planning on going. Because you wanted to go over here, and he says, no, in the storm, let's go over here. And that's why you don't trust him. And so that's why you don't cry out to him. Maybe it's reasons like that that we read here at the end that Jesus rebuked the disciples too. I mean, he just bluntly told them, you know what? You guys need faith. Verse 25, he said to them, where's your faith? I mean, these followers of Jesus, probably most of them, at least the 12 apostles, had plenty of evidence affirming Jesus' absolute authority. These people, for sure, by this point, I'm quite sure, had seen Jesus turn water into wine. They had seen him heal all manner of sickness. They had seen him cast out demons. They had seen him give sight to the blind, hearing to the deaf. I'm sure by this point they'd seen him raise the dead. What else is there? I think by this time it's entirely possible they had watched Jesus take a few loaves of bread and a couple of fishes and bless them and feed thousands of people. I mean, how many times had they watched Jesus cast a demon out of an innocent victim? How odd to conclude that Jesus has authority over spirit powers, over food, over physical problems, even over death. He can't do anything about wind. Why would we conclude stuff like that? And so Jesus' rebuke, I think, was pretty accurate and no doubt justified. This was a test that God the Father not only allowed but sent to show the disciples how weak their faith was and how they really were not depending on Christ. They really didn't know Christ. So they couldn't trust Christ. And so Jesus virtually implies in this statement, you don't have any faith at all. That's kind of what it says. Where's your faith? And he has the same right to rebuke us for not trusting him with these really, really simple passing matters of a passing life. Some of you remember our history teacher while we were in college who would introduce an exam like this. Remember? This too shall pass. I think about that so many times. Just whatever it is that's going on in life, this too shall pass. Can you trust God to sustain you while it's passing? Well, Jesus certainly proved his trustworthiness when he commands the sea and the wind and it calms. And how did the disciples respond? Well, actually, with fear instead of faith. Up to this point, they'd been afraid. There isn't any question about that. They were deathly afraid of the circumstances of life because they thought they were undone. They thought they were going to be destroyed. So they were afraid of that which they could not control. Jesus changes all that, and what happens? Now they're afraid of Jesus because they can't comprehend him. Last part of verse 25, they were afraid. They marveled, saying to one another, who then is this that he commands even winds and water and they obey him? You know, it's kind of wonderful to be suddenly, unexpectedly slammed with all the authority of Jesus to see who he is. It kind of reminds me that I know it's true for me, and I think it might be for you. We know Jesus very little. Some know him well through the circumstances that he's allowed them to go through, but most of us not well. But I know in the end, In the end, one day, we are going to stand in the very presence of Jesus Christ, and we are going to know even as we are known. And folks, I'm telling you, we're going to be shocked. We are going to be absolutely flabbergasted at the authority and power and abilities that our Master has available to us. So why not in this life fear Him now? You say, well, I don't want to be afraid. That's not what the word means. To fear the Lord is to own a deep, life-changing, awesome respect for Him. And the better we know Him, the deeper that respect is. If we could just somehow catch a small glimpse of His authority, we'd fear Him. Now, I know either you have already faced some pretty difficult, unexpected circumstances in your life, and if you haven't, I can just about assure you, you will. That's life. I mean, that's what it's like to live in a world that is tainted by sin. That's what it is like to live in relationship with a God who wants us to trust Him. How are you going to respond? It's okay. In fact, it's good for us to get to the point very quickly where we just say, I'm perishing. I can't handle this thing. You feel like just giving up sometimes? Maybe you're so afraid today at circumstances of your life, you just kind of feel like jumping overboard because you don't know what else to do. Well, go see Jesus. Cry out to Him. Tell Him what you think. And He will remind you of what He knows. And He will remind you of how He cares. And how He really does respond to you. And as you see Him do this through the promises of His Word and the way He cares for you and the circumstances of your life, you know what's going to happen? Your faith in Him is going to grow deeper and deeper and deeper. And your respect for Him is going to get broader and broader. And you will be able to say, I know Jesus. That's what He wants for His people, who He desires to live in fellowship with Him.